Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Abdullah Samir podcast. We are now at episode 66. Today, I have a special guest. His name is Sven, and Sven is from Norway, the Great North. And as we were just discussing, you have a period coming up where there's going to be no sunlight.
Yeah, it's the dark times where the sun disappears for almost 2 months. Yeah.
And then you have periods with no sunset. It's just sun all day long, right?
Yeah, the summertime is midnight sun. So there you have, it's like living up here. The whole winter and summertime is like the summer is like a big long day, and the winter is like a long night. So it's crazy.
Oh wow! So how's it going? You emailed me, I guess, and we were having a conversation about this, about going live. You were a little bit nervous about it, right? Just to be honest, I mean, you felt a little bit nervous about coming online, telling your story. How are you feeling now?
No, I'm feeling good. Yeah.
Awesome. good. So let's get into it. Let's talk about how did this whole thing come about? Let's go way back. You're in a place with what is it like a big Muslim population there, small Muslim community, and you know, from there, how did you find out about Islam and how did you end up converting to Islam?
Yeah, sure. I can start with my upbringing. I was raised Christian. It is called the Lutheran Lestadius. I don't know the English Lestadius, but it's a very strict form of Christianity. So it maybe have some similarities with Islam in one way, because they make a lot of things haram. It's, music is prohibited unless you sing psalms, you know. It's not supposed
to. Wow, music.
It can lead to inappropriate behavior, like.
Like dancing and all that, right?
Yeah, sexual things and like this thing. So it's not considered a very good thing to do.
Mm.
And TV and things like this, like going to the movies, things that is a part of the world is considered not to be the best. But you got two groups, and the one is more extreme and the other one is more liberal. And I grew up in the more liberal, so fortunately, my grandparents and my mother was more like, yeah, sure, you can go to the movies and these things are great. But in the religion itself, it has elements of a lot of prohibition for things.
Oh, yeah.
You're very sinful by nature. So that's what I grew up with. And so a lot of Bible studies and these things. But my mother met my stepfather in Morocco when I was a teen. I was 12 years old, and he was from Senegal, but he was working in Morocco. And they got married, and he moved up here. And so my stepfather then was a Muslim. He was practicing Sufi Muslim. So in Senegal, you have a lot of Sufis. And he was really the one that first introduced me to Islam, but of course he was in the family and these things. And my whole introduction to Islam, you could say, is I only have good things to say. It was a very beautiful introduction by my stepfather. I remember the first time I heard him pray, and just the sound of the prayer and the thing was really appealing to me. So I felt attracted to the whole prayer. But of course, as a teen, you have your own things, and I was not into religion in that way. I was still fighting with my own upbringing, religion being rebellious, and religion was not the thing. But when I became older, I used to discuss religion with my stepfather and these things, and he had one thing that he used to say that even today I thank him for, and I think it was a really beautiful thing when it comes to religion. He said, like, religion is one thing that you shouldn't be promoting outside or saying or trying to impose religion on people. He said, you keep it in your heart, and by your own character and your own, like, tranquility or your peace, then maybe people will approach you and ask you, like, what is up with you? Why do you have so much peace? And then you can tell them, I guess it's because I'm a Muslim or because of Islam, these things. So that was like his idea of being a Muslim. And he was a very open-minded guy, I would say. He was not the strict type of Muslim. So more and more I felt Islam as doing my own digging. And unfortunately, my stepfather, he died of lung cancer many years ago, when I was 20, 20, early 20s. But it was always something that stuck with me, the whole, his introduction to Islam, for me, was very appealing. And especially with my upbringing, where you have this sinful nature, and that you are like a sinful human being, and you should just be, that everything you do is like sinful. You just should be happy that, or to be honest, my my upbringing religion was like, you just hope for death and try to not be as sinful as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, I'm not a lot of, like, the members of that church or this, like, 70% of the people have cancer. I mean, like, they're always sick, and this is like so much sickness. I think it has something to do with the whole view of life, you know. That you shouldn't really be born.
Were they like old as well? Or could that would explain if there was a lot of old people in the church.
Yeah, of course you have old, but you also have young. You're mostly born into it. I mean, like, you don't do much preaching, and then also interesting to like recruit so much members. You're usually born into it, and it goes to family and these things.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, but I was more and more, like I said, my introduction to Islam was like romantic. It was something that really appealed to me, and the prayers, it was something spiritual. I really enjoyed the whole sound of the prayers, especially the Al-Fatiha and all these things, and I really felt that it's something there. And so I eventually converted after some conversation with some Muslims. And, you know, the usually introduction, at least, that you get, there is one God, you know, and all the prophets, like Jesus is there. You have, there is no difference really between Christianity, really, just that there. Yeah, Christianity has been corrupted and these things. It made sense at the time because I had problems with my religion when it came to operating that form of Christianity. And the whole idea of not being born into sin, as Islam has, was liberating for me. It was like, okay, so you're born in a pure state of Islam, and then it's more what you do later in life, and these things was really appealing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like when you say that, you know, it sounded the whole prayer and the call to prayer, it sounded like, you know, mysterious and spiritual. I found that as well, that when I, you know, when you listen to any sort of religious thing, whether it's like, you know, a beautiful church opera, like church hymns and songs, or whether you're in, you know, the Hindu bhajans, or even the Sikh when they're reading the holy book. I felt that experience even as a Muslim. I went into a Sikh temple and I was like hearing them recite it, and I felt like my hair's standing up, and I'm like, why am I feeling like this? I'm Muslim. I'm only supposed to feel like this about the Quran, not about these man-made religions. But it has that impact, right? Because there's something about these like rituals that we find sort of like, it has this appeal, right? It's very human appeal.
Yeah, it does. Even now I see like if you have a mantra, or you have something like, to say, a Hindu or Sikh or whatever, I can get the same sensation.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not about only the Muslim.
Yeah. Friend. Yeah, because sometimes we see these videos of like, they're like non-Muslim listens to the Quran and they're like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. But a lot of the times they don't show them like the translation, and they will be burned and roasted in the fire forever, and their skins will be, but it sounds like Aleph Lam Mim. Like it sounds so beautiful. And they're like, oh wow, this is so beautiful. But like, it's actually talking about like all of these, like, you know, things that you wouldn't find beautiful if you understood what it was saying. But it sounds appealing. So which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it does. So that's, and also I find out that it got a lot of to do with the voice. If you it's a guy with a beautiful voice. If you have a guy with not so beautiful voice reciting the same verse, it will not have the same effect. So that's also
that's interesting. So yeah, so do continue. So then what happened next?
Yeah, I mean, like I did my shahada in the mosque with an Australian guy there that had converted, and he was at that time he was like one of the leaders in the mosque. And his wife had also converted with him, and she was local. And so he was teaching me a little bit of Arabic and doing, teaching me the prayers, how to do them.
Was this, you said there's basically two mosques, two masjids over there. One of them is a more liberal Sufi sort of accept all the Muslims. And the other one was a Salafi, Wahhabi, like hardline one. Which one did you go to?
Well, I started out with the Wahhabi. As because it's a much, the thing is, it's a much greater looking mosque, and it got much more room.
Saudi funded, right?
Of course. The thing is that before, there was, in 2010, they were supposed to build, Saudi wanted to build a mosque here. They wanted to found it, and they wanted to build it next to the church, the famous church. It was supposed to be very big. And the politicians was like, there was people for and against. But it got shut down. You can Google it also, because they found out that one of the leaders in the mosque had some connection to Al Qaeda or something in 90s, something. Yeah.
Wow.
So when that got exposed, then the whole project got shut down. But now you have you got two mosques, like you said. You have the one Somalian, and you have the one that is founded from Saudi. And I started out in the Saudi mosque. Because there's where I met this guy who did the shahada with me and teach me, and that was where he was going. So, but I didn't feel comfortable there. There was so much strict rules, and you always felt like you were being watched, and if you were doing things correctly, if you were I felt more uncomfortable than I did in my church in my childhood. So I went to the Somalia mosque, where I felt much more welcome, and it was much more relaxed. atmosphere. And you have some Sufi practitioners there. It's not very common, but they are allowed to be in the mosque. And in the other mosque, it's not allowed. You will be kicked out. So it's more acceptance over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then, yeah, so you went to the mosque that was more liberal. And I guess that's, we all find ways to kind of what appeals to us naturally. The Salafi mosque was probably more like your old church, whereas the Sufi mosque was more like accepting, and they put different emphasis on different things. For me, I was the opposite. I appealed to the, for whatever reason, the Salafi sort of movement. I found it to be more pure, probably because I came from a different sect of Islam. So for me, I felt like I wanted the pure Islam, the straight, you know, standard, you know, the best one. So I didn't want any of this. And it all depends on, you know, who's influencing you and what you're watching and what you're reading. So I was influenced by a lot of online Bilal Phillips and all these people that were Salafi leaning. In your case, you had a choice and you picked the one that was more comfortable for you. What happened after that? So you were Muslim for 8 years after that. Like you said, you did go in and out, but like what happened after that?
After that, well, life happened. Like it's not 24 hours Islam for 8 years, but I was a practicing Muslim. And I felt comfortable with it. It was my way of life, you know, and I viewed Islam as the perfect way of life. And I promoted it like to people I met, family, everything. It's like, you know, Islam is the greatest way of life. I wish you all could see it. You know, it's scientific. It is it's the most perfect way. It's like, and today I feel ashamed of that because I was really a promoter of like talking Islam to be the best way of life. I also consider it to be the most misunderstood religion ever, because my view was that Wahhabi and Salafi was like the wrong path. Yeah. Like where you have being misguided, so that's like the difference is for me it was more the Sufi path, of course, was like the more spiritual path, and that you also when you, what is the word when you supposed to, the English word, interpretate.
Okay, interpret. Yeah. Yeah, the
Quran is supposed to be also more spiritual than was mine. And then I thought that, yeah, this really makes sense at that time, of course. Mm.
Yeah, someone's asking, what is Wahhabi? So Wahhabi is basically a movement that was, it's known for being connected to Saudi Arabia right now, but basically Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, which was this guy, this sheikh in was lived in the Saudi area, and basically the kingdom of Saudi Arabia was founded with them, with their help. They're the ones. So basically there was an alliance between, you know, the Al Saud, the king, the one who became the king of Saudi, and these religious leader. This religious leader agreed to convince people to fight jihad for the Saudi family in order to take over the land and to make it his land, right? Which is now why you have the Saudi kingdom. It's named after the king, right? And this is a very hardline version of Islam that doesn't have any room for like the very strict, rigid interpretation that goes straight to basically what's directly in the hadith. And, you know, Sufis were more spiritual. And actually, I do agree that Sufis are more spiritual, because the Saudi, you know, Wahhabi version of Islam is actually bad for the world. It's a version that is very antagonistic between believers and disbelievers. It's against, you know, I think both versions don't like music, but, you know, at least with the Sufis, you have people that allow some music. You have people that allow celebrating the birthday of the Prophet, which is, could be a fun celebration. With the Wahhabi version of Islam, it's like there's not a lot of things going on. It's a lot of emphasis on rituals, on, you know, on what you're like basically all of the rituals are very important, but there's no emphasis on the inner meaning as much, and it's very different, right? And these are both sides consider themselves misguided. You know, I to this day I still get people telling me you left Islam because you were Salafi, meaning Wahhabi. And I get, you know, Salafis that say, oh, you didn't know Salafism properly, that's why you left. It's like both sides think they're wrong, right? Side wants to everyone thinks they're right, I guess. That's how religion is in general.
Like, same. I get like, you were never a real Muslim because you were Sufi. You know, so if you were not Sufi, maybe it would be different. But so yeah, you always have that. And but I was like, I told my stepfather did make a really big impact, and I think he's the reason also why I choose Sufi as a lineage, and that because what he practiced and the way he interpreted Islam was really beautiful. It gave meaning, and I always admire him for his discipline and his he was just a peaceful guy, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm sorry for your loss as well. I, you know, sorry to hear that he died from cancer. That's obviously difficult.
So, yeah. The funny thing, he never smoked, he never drank. But, yeah.
It happens, eh? It happens. And humanity, we're on the way to cure cancer, you know. We still have a way to go, but, you know, we're gonna get it. It's just a matter of time, I think. But yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, many people did die. Even people that sometimes don't drink and smoke.
But he was a good guy. Of course, he was human also. He had his faults, but he had some fight. I remember as a young teen, I was into Buddhism at a point. But that he could not accept. He said, you're going to curse the whole family. Because of Buddhism, of course, and because idolatry, no idol, you know.
That's so weird, because I mean, I know there's certain forms of Buddhism, like where they have gods and they have avatars and demigods, but like the actual core Buddhist teachings is all, there's no god. It's a godless religion.
Of course, but in the Muslim view, it's not. But it's funny because I tried to explain, but you know, no, it's of course because you have an idol, and that's very haram. So
yeah. So then what happened? Like, what made you to? I guess that explains, now that we know your journey to Islam, and you know, you made a very good point that people need to know that. There's many Muslims out there who are good people, that are good examples, that are, you know, good, like, members of society. And they just live their life. They just want to live their life. They're not hurting anybody. I always want to emphasize this point, especially when we talk about leaving Islam and Islam being bad. I always want to make a point when people mention this, because these, you know, sometimes people want to use Islam, you know, when we talk about Islam and we say Islam is bad, they want to use that to say all Muslims are bad, and we definitely don't want to say that, because as you said, you know, he was a good man, and there are good people like that in the world, in all groups, in all religions, in all, you know, countries.
It sure is. There is so much variation in Islam, is my experience, and all Muslims are not the same. It's very different. But of course, I met many bad Muslims as a Muslim also, and you have that in everything. But you wanted to know how my doubts came about.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the bad Muslims, or should we just like?
Well, I'm just saying I remember especially one episode where it was this old guy. And I was outside waiting for my friend finishing work. I was going to visit him, and I just came, and he hadn't came from work yet. So he invited me home. He said, come inside and you know, I prepare something for you to eat and some tea to drink. And like a very, very nice guy. old guy, and he was Arab. I don't remember where he came from, but and we talked, and yeah, and he's like, "You Muslim?" And yes, and all such great, and we had a very good conversation till a point where it just, he wanted to explain me something. He took the apple and he said, like, and he dropped it on the floor and he said, "Would you like to eat this apple if I had peeled it, you know?" And it got dropped on the floor. I said, "No, but if it has the skin on it, you could eat it, right?" I said, "Yeah, sure." That was like a metaphor for the hijab. But the thing that came was, like, he said, "And if my daughter would refuse, I would kill her." And at that point, I was like, "Whoa, where did that come from?" And like, the quick change. And
that escalated quickly.
It really did. And yeah. That's an example where I had some experience with some Muslims where it escalated pretty quickly. And it were like, it came from peace and love and harmony till like, but if not, we go hard. So that
In some ways too, you know, I would say is connected to the theology. Although it's kind of a weird dynamic, because in Islam you would be punished for, you know, killing your daughter.
Yeah.
Yet this whole idea, this purity culture, like a lot of it comes from Islam, this idea of even this Arab honor, this, you know, the idea of honor in the family. I feel like it's a mix of like Islamic teachings and cultural teachings. But of course, in Islam itself, you would be probably killed if you killed your daughter. I don't know if that would be the exact punishment, but it would be haram too, because, you know, it says in the Quran that the man that buries his daughter alive will be asked on the Day of Judgment why he did that. So obviously you're not allowed to, if there was any sort of, and this is just, we're talking about just for wearing hijab. We're not even talking about zina. So no. Obviously, you know, whether it's a case of mental, guys, a mental issue, maybe boundary issues, control issues. But of course you tend to hear more of this with them when it comes to like religious teachings. Like you don't hear non-Muslims say, "I'll kill my daughter if she wears a skirt or something." That's weird. Like, that doesn't even happen.
It's not putting it in a religious setting. Of course, you have people that is mentally unstable that will maybe, but in a religious, I never heard in Christian community or like, especially not Buddhist, but yeah.
Yeah, and that's why we want to talk about these things. We want to talk about these bad ideas. And sometimes, I think sometimes the bad ideas, they don't originate in Islam. Again, like killing your daughter is not allowed in Islam. The hadith says that whoever raises two daughters or three daughters, and he raises them well, he'll go to paradise, right? So I think there's some connection there with this idea of honor, which you find in Afghani culture, in Arab culture, and probably in Somali culture. Although more, like even among Arab countries, you find more of this in Jordan, for example, than Kuwait. Like, although I did hear a case that happened recently in Kuwait where there was a woman that was, a pregnant woman that was killed. Usually you don't hear about it in Kuwait. Usually you hear about it in Jordan, but you don't hear about this in Malaysia at all. Right, Indonesia, like these Muslim countries, there's no honor killings as far as I know. Maybe there's a couple, but there's definitely, with the Arab thinking, there's this big thing about honor, and you dishonor my family. And there's even a Saudi girl that was posting on Twitter, you know, it's a very sad story that like she had sex outside of marriage, and her dad wants her to take a virginity test at the doctor who's his friend, and she's scared. She's literally thinks they're gonna kill her. And she might be right. I mean, this is how bad it gets. And I don't know exactly where that's coming from. I think there's a mixture of different things going on. Obviously, if you had premarital sex in Islam, you would be executed. But again, you wouldn't be executed if no one knew about it. And if the family knew about it, it would be their job to hide it. You wouldn't be going and exposing it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like nobody, if the dad or the mom knows that the daughter did it, nobody's forcing them to tell anybody. And of course it happens all the time, because this is Saudi, but there's still girlfriends and boyfriends. There's still a lot of things going on, right? It's just not out in the open, but you know, the men in that society, they want to control, they want to control women's sexuality, and they see the vagina as a reflection of the women's vaginas in the family to be a reflection of their honor. It's very strange, right? It's very I think it's very foreign for people like me and you. We don't think like that, like, you know.
No. I don't know. My country has some connection to the Vikings, so maybe the Vikings did a lot of raping and you know, plundering and this. So it's also what you I mean, culture is also a thing, of course, and I don't blame it all on Islam, because I know there is many, like you said, Islam, it's prohibited in Islam to kill your daughter.
Yeah.
And there's where also my point where I started to doubt Islam was like, eventually it was like, I felt the whole religion was very schizophrenic, you know. It especially reading the hadith, it didn't make sense. It made things not so clear. Like Islam is supposed to be the clear path. It's supposed to be very clear, but
it was
just the opposite. The more and more I got deeper into Islam by studying it and going deeper and deeper, it was like, this is not clear at all. It's more and more unclear.
It gets worse and worse as you learn more. When you embrace Islam, you're like, beautiful religion, mashallah. As you start to learn more, you get confused and more confused and more. So do you have any examples of like the I think that's a beautiful term. It's a schizophrenic religion. Like, can you have examples of what you mean by that?
No, I remember my first doubt, you know, like, you know, the narrative you're being told is before Islam, right? They used to bury their daughters alive and these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the story of Khadija. You know, she was a wealthy woman, and she hired Muhammad and all this, and rich, independent woman was my view. Like, this, in one way, doesn't make very much sense, being like how the society was supposed to be at that time. It seemed like women had much rights, right?
Yeah.
So it was contradicting itself by the example of Khadija.
That's a good point. That's actually a good point. I just want to add to that a bit. The idea that Khadija, this woman in Arabia, was doing her own business, had a lot of wealth she inherited from her father, or I guess her father, uncle or something, and she was able to basically hire men, work with men, do business, do trade, and get more wealthy, contradicts the idea that Islam, the talking point that Muslim apologists use, which is Islam was so bad, pre-Islamic Arabia was so bad for women, they couldn't do anything, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was trying to make sense of that. Really, was she the only exception? Like, Or is there something that's not like completely right? But there was also like, I remember where I first like really, it was of course some hadiths that didn't make sense, like was contradicting the behavior of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. Like you're always being told the greatest example. And then you have, I would understand if it was not from Islamic sources, you know, then you could say there's people trying to discredit Islam or doing this, but it's the own sources that, like, for me, why keep this if it's making so much harm? And also, I started to have problems with Muhammad as the perfect example, as the biggest role model. And even for me to be a Sufi, where you consider it to be spiritual and these things, because I had you're doing some mental gymnastic, you know, trying to interpret some things, you really have to do that.
You have to work really hard. And especially among Sufis, like with Sufis, Muhammad is like, I don't want to say he's God, but he's like next to God compared to, like, you know, Salafis, they have a certain maqam of Muhammad. He's the best man and whatever. But Sufis, he's the, like, I've heard one Sufi mosque, they actually said all of this universe and everything in it before and after was made for Muhammad. Like, yeah, that is Muhammad's status in the Sufi community. Like, they're crying for him and this and that. You don't find, like, Salafis crying about Muhammad. Like, they don't have that connection, right? But no, now you... Hmm?
Yeah, so that's why it's very important to feel love for Muhammad in the Sufi. And if you start to struggle with that, you're not a good Sufi.
Yeah, right? Not a good Muslim, so, even.
No, not a good Muslim.
Yeah.
I mean,
so do you have any examples of what Muhammad did that was like caused you problems? Like, you have a specific example that what did you read about this in a hadith? Did you hear about this at a khutbah and you're like, oh, this is odd? Because I know that even as, you know, my wife is a convert to Islam and I was a sort of convert because I changed sects, and I used to come across things when I read the hadith and I was like, oh, that's weird. Like, Muhammad did this. But then I would ask my friends, they would come up with something. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. And my wife would come and ask me certain things, and I'd be like, I'd come up with some explanation, and then we'd be like, yeah, okay, that's fine. And we found ways to make peace with some of these things, even though really I don't think we had peace with it, but I think we were just kind of letting it go because we felt like we couldn't be right, because of course this religion is from God. So your authority is coming from God, so you can't be right. You know, it has to be God is right. You can't be right.
Yeah, I mean, like, my was like, it's probably right. It's just me who doesn't get it. You know, I'm not
exactly
mature enough, or like, there is something I'm not getting here.
Exactly.
But I don't remember the exact, like, number of hadith or, like, Jane, but I remember there was one hadith that really made an impact, and it was the one, you can help me with it, where there is some men who comes to Muhammad to, because they have problem with the heat, right? And he says to camel urine, to go and get camel urine, this, and I don't remember correctly if it was that they stole the camel or something.
Yeah.
But the punishment was so barbaric that, like, forget about the Vikings. This was really, like, oh, the nails or the eyes, what it was real bad. I was like, can't be a merciful. This is not merciful at all. It's not, it doesn't make any sense at all. So that really shaked me. But then it's like the whole thing with, oh, it's not the real hadith, or like,
Well, this one was definitely a strong hadith. This is in Bukhari, so this is the best, one of the most authentic collections. And even there's a verse in the Quran that talks about the punishment for those who do treason is you chop off the opposite leg and hand, and they'll be crucified, right? So it is kind of mentioned in the Quran as well. Not this specific thing, but yeah, this is like extremely bad. You know,
you not don't get that for instruction, like introduction for joining Islam. This is not what in the
time. Yeah.
If you had those hadiths, then it would be different.
Yeah.
So, but there was many cases like this.
So I'm curious, were you reading these in a book yourself, or was this mentioned to you in the khutbah? How did you find out? Did you see it on the internet? Was it an ex-Muslim that brought these to your attention? Where did this come from, this hadith?
No, I was reading myself. I thought more and more, and I just, by accident, like, it came this hadith. And I used to borrow also some books from the mosque. And there suddenly it could pop up some things that's like, this doesn't make any sense. Let me check it out. And I just dig more and more, especially online, doing like, but this, of course, through Islamic websites, because that's trustworthy, you know.
Yeah.
Because like I mentioned to you before, like I saw a video of David Wood and Nabi. They had that thing where they was reading hadiths. That was really crazy. But that didn't affect me at all. I just felt like, no, this is like people who is Islamophobic, or, you know, this is people trying to discredit Islam. They don't know anything. And even though he never was a Muslim, you know, he was never a real practicing Muslim. So he was maybe undercover Christian, you know. So.
But a Nabil, you mean?
Muslim. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's like my mindset as a Muslim, like you're very paranoid, or like very like, no, ex-Muslims or people who talk against Islam, they just don't get it. You know, they misinterpreted something, or they haven't, they don't really get it, no. Sounds like a cult, really. No, you just don't get it. You just join, yeah. you will get it. But yeah. So
while you were a Muslim and you were you did find these hadith that were problematic, and I think in general this hadith is very problematic for even Muslims. I mean, I remember many Muslims kind of questioning this. I remember, as I told you, I changed sects from Ismaili to Sunni. There's a famous ex-Ismaili. Famous guy that like actually went against like Ismailis, and he was making a lot of people become Sunni, and he actually stopped believing in hadith because of this hadith, among others. Like, he was like, this is crazy, how could Muhammad do such a thing? And so he left, you know, he said, I'm not going to follow hadith anymore, even though, because this is an authentic hadith, so you can't say it's a weak hadith. And then because of that, he left the hadith behind. But what about like actually practicing Islam? Did you find it like you said in Norway, you have long days and the prayer times are connected to, you know, the daylight hours, because Muhammad, he probably didn't know that there's places in the world where you have 24 hours of sunset. And if you're going to fast, or if you're going to try to pray, your prayers are going to be spread out through the whole day.
Yeah, there is certain places in the world where if you become a Muslim, you're very unlucky. Abdullah?
Yeah, sorry, I'm still here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, there is some places in the world, if you are a Muslim, you really get it hard practicing. And the prayers, like, from the prayers time from month to month, they change. And there is some months where there can be, like, Isha prayer can be almost before midnight, and then you have Fajr at 2 o'clock in the night.
So and Isha is the night prayer, and Fajr is a dawn prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to basically, before you go to bed, or I guess before you go to bed, because you can't wake up at 12 o'clock, right? So you have to sleep at like...
You know, my stepfather used to have an alarm constantly ringing. And there was not much consistency in sleep, really.
Oh my God!
And the same thing you get, like, if you want to stay awake to Isha, you gotta be staying a long time. And then if you go to bed, then you gotta be up 2.5 hour later. You know, this of course is not every month, but some months can be very difficult if you really want to make the prayers on time.
Yeah, and this isn't optional. You have to do this. This is like, you have to pray 5 times a day. And if you miss a prayer, you have to make it up. You have to pray another time. So I know, even without being in Norway, with just being in Canada, I mean, we never get Isha at 12 o'clock. We get Isha at like maybe 10 o'clock. But even then, as a teenager, I found it tough, because I'm like, sometimes I had to wake up like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't want to sleep at like 11. I wanted to go to bed early, and I used to find it tough. So I can just imagine in a country like Norway, where you basically either you have to miss the prayer every single time, or you just feel guilty and you pray late. You know, I mean, both of those. I mean, or you just don't sleep at all, right?
Yeah, I find it hard to believe that every Muslim over here really does all the prayers the whole year on time. Because it will be very difficult. I mean, then if you have a job in between, like you're working, it's gonna be difficult, and family and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it really affects your life quality. And Islam, like for me, I started to think Islam should really affect your quality of life in a bad way. Didn't God make it easy for you? But the thing is that even now as a non-Muslim, I miss the prayers. It can be times where I miss it. Not that as obsessive have to do it and this, but I miss sometimes the prayer. Yeah.
Mm. What I do if I'm looking for something like that is I'll wake up early in the morning and I'll meditate, or in the evening I'll just give myself a quiet moment. Obviously I don't read Quran because I don't have any value in that, but I know what you mean. You feel like you're connecting yourself with God, you're reading his holy words, and you feel like this is something really happening there when you're bowing down. You know, all of these rituals, they can give you peace and comfort when they're not getting in the way of your life, you know?
Yeah, you can do yoga, of course, and you can do meditation, and it will also have effect. But I mean, as a Sufi, the prayer was considered to be very spiritual. And for me, it was. It was where I had my connection with God, you know? It was... yeah. Times I can miss it, but if I do yoga and meditation also, I really don't. It has the same effect, even better at times, because you don't have to recite and be all up in your mind also. Because there is a lot of mind work as a convert also to do the prayers.
Yeah.
Especially, but then it becomes like automatic, and then it's no. That's also the problem. It becomes just a ritual where everything is like on autopilot. So
I agree with you. When you have to do something that often, you lose the mindfulness part of it, because you have to do it five times a day, and it's just like so often that like the inner value, it becomes a challenge, like khushu, as they call it, having mindfulness, or having a connection, you know, being there in the moment. It's not easy to maintain that when you have to do it so often, and it's like forced upon you. Easier if you could choose when you wanted to do it, and then you decided, I want to pray now, or I want to fast, or whatever. And I guess these problems also are with fasting too, not just praying, right? Because with fasting, how do you fast Ramadan for 24, close to 24 hours, or in some cases like 6 hours? It all depends when you're Muslim. So when you converted to Islam, because it cycles through the year, was it a long fast or the short fast? Which one did you end up getting?
Well, it's long, but I mean, Saudi did a thing where they were supposed to help us in the north, where they made the times and this. So we followed Saudis where they made a program. It can be, and to be honest also, I didn't for 8 years I didn't do Ramadan all those 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was impossible. I couldn't function, and there also where my logical mind kicked in and said, like, if I don't function for a month, I mean, like, I can't do it. It's like, so
it's definitely one of the toughest religions, isn't it? Like having to do all of these things.
That's the funny thing, where you always been told like Islam is so easy and perfect, but yeah, it's really difficult, especially if you follow like the ritual way of Islam, where you have to take that feet before you enter the toilet and. Yeah, a'udhu billahi in shaitani rajim before you enter every time, and bismillah, and you know, like all those rituals that make like you become obsessive of I just have to do this, I have to do it this way, and you know, that's it doesn't feel natural. Mm-hmm. But of course, now I'm speaking as a non-Muslim, but in And yeah, it felt forced upon, something that didn't fit. As human nature, it was not natural. That was what also I started to find out, that this is not, it felt artificial, like something that is not natural. Yeah.
I find it interesting that when Ramadan comes, they come and they give you special prayer times. But for the rest of the year, you got to go by the normal prayer times. It's like there's only a special exception for fasting, because fasting is almost impossible otherwise. But it's the same thing for the prayers too. The prayers, if the fasting times are different, then the prayer times should be. And I always wondered as a Muslim, because I know that in the UK, when it got too long, that's just like in Norway. They had this thing where they came up with special times. They shortened the prayer times. And I always used to wonder, why did they shorten it at 18, but not say 16? Why is it okay to do 16-hour fast? Because in summer in the Toronto area, you have around 16 hours of fasting, which is pretty damn long if you have to do it every single day for 30 days. I was thinking, like, why is that considered okay? But if it gets to like 17, 18, 19, now it's, you know, some people will do it anyways. They'll do the 18-hour fast. Some people can't do it. And so it becomes kind of like up in the air. Would you want to follow the Norway times, or do you want to follow? I mean, in your case, I think it's just totally impossible. But in our case, there was people that were like wondering, you know, why don't we get, you know, an exception? Why don't we have a fatwa? But nobody wants to make that fatwa. Nobody wants to say, well, let's change the times and make it more practical. They'll just go by, they'll just do it. And I think a lot of people just don't do it. They don't admit it, but they just won't fast.
Let us have some water, please. It's just not healthy, I think, also.
Yeah.
Not at all. And the sleep is not good.
Oh, yeah.
So that's also, but you know what they're going to say then, Islam was too hard for you. As
well. Exactly. Yeah, that's what they'll say, right?
Yeah. So I was not hardcore enough. But
the thing is, it's like when we see these issues, what we find is an inconsistency in the design. We see problems in the design of Islam. That why is it that, like, you know, some parts of the world have these crazy prayer times, these crazy fasting times, and then, you know, people in the Middle East are so lucky, they have pretty stable prayer times for the whole year. Like, I'm from Kenya, you know, I was asking my uncle, he's like, yeah, the prayer times, they don't change for the whole year. We always have Dhuha because it's right at the equator, right? So it's like the prayer times are static.
Yeah, but that's why I think it was made for that area. It's not a universal religion. It doesn't function as a universal religion at all. And you got to do the prayers in Arabic and all these things. It doesn't seem like the most universal religion at all. But there was also one, I remember I had a conversation with a Muslim friend that it have happened attack in Somalia. It was Al-Shabaab that had killed a lot of people and a lot of kids also. And some people in the mosque said that, but it's the will of God, you know, because nothing happens without the will of Allah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make any sense, really, because if bad and good happens by the will of Allah, then what's the role of the devil, really? Where does he fit in all of this? Yeah. If good and bad is from the one source that is God, then what is the devil doing, really? Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely. So I think the older Abrahamic religion, which is Judaism, you know, had this issue as well, which is why when it came to Christianity, the devil started to play a bigger role in the whole thing, because it became a problem that if you only have one God, I mean, when you go to Zoroastrianism, you have two gods, God of good and God of evil. There's a duality, right? But then when you only have one God, well, then is God responsible for all of the suffering in the world and all of the evil and all of the bad things? So then, oh, there's a devil. The devil is the one that's responsible. And then, of course, in Islam, of course, the devil is even also plays a big role in misguiding people, and God let him misguide people. You're right. It's very strange because, it definitely feels like the whole thing is a post, you know, hoc rationalization. It's like, why does the evil in the world? Oh, there must be a devil, and the devil made the bad people do it. But then why did God allow the devil to do it? Because he wants to test us. So, you know, why this whole thing just because it sounds like a made up explanation. I mean, that's what it sounds like. And of course, that's what it is.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's like you said that it's God that misleads people. And if you get cut out of Islam, and you know, it's because of its God's will.
Yeah.
He blocked you out. So then really that, like, but shouldn't that be the devil? Devil, right? You know, there was these minor things where it just became like, I don't get it anymore, really. I have to dig deeper and find out because the foundation was starting to crumble. The whole foundation where you have, there is one God and all the prophets and, you know, only worship one God, and this simple, solid structure just started crumbling because of all these things that I have mentioned. It just became more and more doubt. And as I think, as a Sufi also, it's more difficult to doubt because you have the whole spiritual thing that you know, like, you're supposed to view it more spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even interpretations, I remember in where you cut the hands of the thief, you know, I was thinking, maybe it's just symbolical, you know, maybe it's not literally. You're trying to do those gymnastic where you're saying, no, but it's maybe not literally. But of course, this is not, the more and more you dig deeper into it, it became more difficult for me to take it spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went more and more away from the spiritual side. Like, this doesn't make any sense anymore spiritually. So then you got to take it literally. And from a literally side, it really doesn't make any sense. Because then it just becomes very primitive and barbaric in many ways. Yeah. Of course, not all. Because even today, I find some beautiful elements in Islam, and there is things that you can say are good and even beneficial, but as a whole, it is not.
Mm-hmm. You
know, that's my view. As a whole, it does not function. But certain elements, of course, yeah. And that's also what I missed when I was seeing like guys as David Wood and those other people, that there was never like an honest opinion about Islam. Like, of course you have some good things. You got some things, yeah, that you don't have to criticize everything. There's a lot to criticize.
But yeah,
there is also, and that's what I like about you, that you keep the balance way, and that's why you also affected me in a very strong way, where I just, yeah. Started to really doubt, and my doubts started to make sense. It was not me that was not understanding it correctly. And you also have the science in the Quran, of course, that I always thought was there, and suddenly it was not. So it's not like the greatest science book ever.
Yeah.
But I remember the introduction pamphlet I got when I came to the mosque for the first time. There it was saying that, in the Quran, it has a lot of science, you know, the embryo, how it's being formed, and all these things. And now they have removed it. It's not longer in the mosque. You cannot even find it on the internet, on the mosque's website. So I don't know if they found out that this doesn't add up, really. But, yeah. So.
Sorry, I was trying to find it. Is it the Brief Illustrated Guide to Understanding Islam? Is that the book you're talking about, or is that a different book?
Can you sh do you have the picture of
Yeah,
the
I'm trying to. Oh, here, I found it. Okay, this one.
Yes.
You know, the funny thing is, I used to give out this book as well. Yeah, me and my friend, we had a dawah booth at the local like the mall. It was a small mall. It wasn't like a huge mall, but it was a small mall in the community. And we used to, I forget who paid for it now. Was it, did we pay for it? Anyways, I was young at the time. Anyways, I was a new Muslim and my friend was doing this and I came to help him. I used to give out these books to people. I used to tell people the embryology miracle, the mountains as pegs, all of these things, you know?
It was just and of course at that time I was fascinated. I was like, really?
Yeah.
Wow. And this is amazing. This is really the truth.
Yeah. And you said it so well, so beautifully that, you know, you got to the point where your doubts started making sense and you were getting more and more confident. And as well, you know, the existence of other ex-Muslims like myself validated your doubts, because when you're doubting all alone, when you're all alone and you're doubting, it's not enough. You just feel like maybe I'm the problem, maybe I'm the one that's making a mistake. But then when there's a rising of more people, and you know, people are together having doubts, then you feel like maybe there's a point to what I'm thinking, and maybe that it's the problem's not me, but maybe the problem is Islam. Maybe the problem is actually there are problems in Islam, and I just didn't want to see it, or I just couldn't see it because for whatever reason, my own biases, or maybe, you know. In some cases, I think people invest too much into the religion, and then you know they go way too deep, and then it's difficult to leave it, right?
Yeah, I mean it becomes a part of you. At least it was for me. And also it was like didn't promote it like you. I didn't go and try to make da'wah to people or this, but in my to friends and to family I was saying like Islam is like the greater, and I always had something to say trying to push them over and say, hey, you just gotta see it. It's just amazing. And
Because you
then,
wanted them to be Muslim and to go to Jannah, right?
yeah, but also the thing, I was not like with the Sufi ideals. It was not like, yeah, you can probably come to Jannah with another path, but
Yeah.
as long as you just have the oneness, or like, or God can appear, like. There is many paths, but Islam is the perfect and the easiest, and the ones that has less pitfalls where you
Yeah.
really are secure,
Oh yeah.
So and yeah, so of course I wanted to share it with my loved ones, but so that's also you became a little bit shameful, like when you start to realize that I was so wrong, and but the funny thing, like you ask, when it comes to ex-Muslims, and especially when I was a Muslim, and I can also understand Muslims now why they are so doubtful about ex-Muslims and people speaking against Islam, because I was one of them. I was one of them who was like, no, it's not real. It's not, he don't get it, it's not, or he's interpreted, or he's not in the right pattern. So
Understanding, right?
yeah,
Yeah.
and so I told the guy that it's a very long way to go, especially it was for me, because you get one foot out and then you take it back, and then like you start to wiggle for a long time, but then suddenly it's like there is no way back. There is no way you can go back. Because you know too much now. If I never started to dig deeper into Islam, I probably would be a Muslim today,
Yeah.
And because it's the more my experience, the more you study it, unless you have two options, I think. you become an extremist where you just take everything literal, and you become hardcore extremist, and something has died inside you of logic in this, but you just by faith. Or, you know, you drop out of it. I mean, you just put your hand in the sand and say, no, it's all fake. Like I the last period, I was only Quranist. It was only Quran because I rejected Hadith. Hadith is fake, even if it's Bukhari or, you know. So it's not, there has must been some corruption by enemies of Islam, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did something from the inside. But this, again, didn't make any sense because Islam is supposed to be protected.
Yeah.
Supposed to be the last revelation, where it's and it got so much problem. It seems like it's the most misunderstood religion in the world. Then.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be the case. You know, even yeah, like, agree with each other is like, if for me, I couldn't like openly sometimes go out and say, yeah, I'm a Sufi. Because that would be not dangerous, but you would get some hostility, you know, mm-hmm. because then you're not following the right path. You're,
I know what you mean.
Yeah. But so that's, yeah. But it was your videos, and I also so what. Is Tarek Fatha, I'm pronouncing it right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know the guy from Pakistan?
Yeah.
And he lives in Canada.
Yep.
I saw he had this one show with Imam Tawheed.
Oh, yeah, Tawheedi, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He had this show, Mullah in Islam, if I'm not mistaken, or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about Hadiths and how it was crazy and how the Mullahs... I was trying to make Islam, you know, something bad and these things. And then I really started to doubt. Like, if you start to doubt on your own sources,
yeah,
then what's left, really?
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't trust your own foundation as a religion, then what's left? And, and when I saw you talking about that you left Islam, and it really like, okay, I'm done. This is not, yeah. And I saw some videos of Christian Prince also. Not a fan of the guy. I don't like things of what he's, how he's doing things with this. But there was one thing where it was mistranslation. Or this thing.
Yeah.
And then one doubt started to come, like, okay, so the mistranslation, because I had many Qurans, mm-hmm. and every Quran almost was different in one way. Mm-hmm. The translation was either, if I got the Wahhabi Quran, it's very, very, how to say it, like, strict language, or it's very
hard to read. It's very hard to read, right? The Mohsin Khan one.
But then you got another translation, and it's much softer, much like totally different interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that also started to mean, like, I don't speak Arabic.
Yeah.
I can't read the Quran. So I gotta trust the translation. And I don't even know if the translation is really being truthful in some cases, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually I left and hasn't looked back after that. Yeah.
It's been about 2 years now, right?
Yeah.
Approximately. Mm-hmm. And I mean, talking about leaving Islam is never easy. It's not like when you come online, I mean, obviously when you put yourself out there, you do feel that there's like a burden, there's a risk involved in, you know, maybe losing some friends, you know, obviously there could be physical threats as well, which some of us have experienced, but there is a real like risk to doing this? I mean, it's not like, why did you want to do this when you know that like this is not like as difficult as this is to talk about this and to admit that, you know, you converted to Islam and it wasn't true. Why did you want to do this?
I just, especially because I think it's very important to get also different perspective, especially from ex-Muslims, because not all ex-Muslims are the same also. We all had different experience. And I can't say that I have been like really damaged by Islam, like many others have. Like you had guests where it's really affected their life dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, it hasn't been that. But also, I wish, I have nothing against Muslims. And I can also say that there is certain elements in Islam that is good. I have some verses in the Quran that, yeah, it's not so bad. But I mean, as a whole, and this, I wish people would not convert. And that's also because it's harmful.
Mm-hmm.
In so many ways, and even for me, where it was not harmful in any like traumatic way, I have been wasting a lot of time,
yeah,
and a lot of unnecessarily doubt, because you start doubting yourself also, like, is something wrong with me because I'm doubting? Is you know, has God left me? Is that why? Or like, have I done something wrong? And of course, there is also not the whole thing with terrorism and these things. It is what makes me frustrated is, yeah, it has, in my point of view, it has a lot of to do with Islam.
Yeah.
Because you can't cut it off. It would like say that, it does. Because it is there in the sources, and you can interpret a lot of things, and you can use a lot of things in Islam to do all these acts. And it's frustrating also because it's not something you talk about under like socially wise, because you get called a racist or like. Right-wing extremist or whatever, and that's not really my case, because I just have a problem with the religion. You know, some elements of the religion is not good, and I wish we could openly discuss the religion. And I see that now is good times for that, with you and a lot of people now just talking openly about it, and in a very honest way, and where you are straight to the point. There is no like, with all due respect to David Wood, and I find him very entertaining, and I like watching his videos, but I feel like you gotta also see all the nuances in between, like, and know. You know, to criticize Islam, also you gotta know Muslims. You gotta know how you think as a Muslim and how you are, because you're also a human. I was not also a Muslim 24 hours just thinking Islam. I had my life, you know, and this. But you have a certain protection. It's like as a Muslim, if anyone criticized the religion, it was defense all down. Not like trying to, but it was like, no, sorry, but you just don't get it. You know, it's just, unfortunately, you're not getting it. Yeah. And today it's quite the opposite. Like, I wish you just would get it, that Islam is harmful. You know, so then it's the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's such a good point that we do need to talk about Islam. We need to make space for people to criticize ideas. This is why blasphemy is so important. We need to end blasphemy laws, because if people like us cannot talk about Islam, then we are giving up the if people like us are called, you know, people like you are called far right just for saying Islam is bad, Well, that's a problem because that doesn't allow for the freedom of discussion. That doesn't allow for the civilization to correct itself, because without these discussions, then, you know, it's like a train wreck. It's just going to keep going in one direction. It's going to get worse and worse, right? So we have to be able to discuss these things.
Yeah. But as a Muslim also, I wish I should have used the race card then, because when people criticize Islam, I should say, oh, you're a racist. But I couldn't do it as a white convert, you know? So when does it become racist? I don't understand really how it got identified with race or these things, because it's supposed to be a universal religion, and this is a religion. And it's much easier to criticize Christianity than it is Islam. Also with Christians, you can discuss it and you know. And yeah, so I like what you're doing, Abdullah. It's you're doing a heck of a job. It's really, and it's reaching far, way back, way up in the north, you know. You helped doubting Muslim to just get rid of its last doubts.
Do you feel like life, thank you, and thank you so much for saying that. Do you feel like life is actually better for you now that you left Islam, or because you miss some things too, right? Do you feel like you're better off now as an ex-Muslim or as an apostate?
You get less guilt. I mean, like, for not doing like full Ramadan and the prayers, it's like, yeah, you feel much more free. Even if you and you know, the crazy thing is, like, sometimes I think, like, how could I be so blind? I will consider myself to be an intelligent guy and smart, but when it came to Islam, something just a screen over my head where I couldn't see things clearly. But I think it's also because I was not exposed to those elements and those things. I had to dig deep. And the thing is also, you got to dig. In my experience, I had to dig deep to find all those things that didn't really make sense. And but my life today, I find, is beautiful. I don't regret it at all. Still miss some of the prayer, but it's good. I feel free, and it's really amazing.
I'm glad for that. I know that, you know, some people go through a traumatic phase of leaving Islam. It's quite difficult. But I'm glad that, you know, you got to experience life as a Muslim, and, you know, you're able to see both sides of the story. I mean, both sides of the picture, being a Muslim and being a non-Muslim. And you found now that after being a Muslim and also not being a Muslim, that life is good without Islam. You know, there's also a narrative out there that whoever, you know, forgets Allah, Allah will forget them and they'll be miserable and whatever, which is so not true. I mean, life goes on, you know, the challenge of life is always going to be there, whether you have religion, whether you have God or not. But without Islam isn't making the world a better place. I mean, it has its benefits for sure. And it's spread for whatever reasons. But as a whole, you know, me and you both agree that it's actually a net loss for the world, which is why I talk about it, which is why you also wanted to share, you know, your perspective, which is great. I mean, the more different stories we get out there, the more people talk about these things, the better educated we can all be, you know, and we can have one more story for other people that are doubting. And of course, it gives more exposure to the movement, to the fact that, you know, Islam is a source of bad ideas in the world today. And, you know, we are taking back the narrative from the Dawah guys, because the Dawah machine is a well-funded, like this book, Brief Illustrated Guide to Understanding Islam, is a glossy booklet. I have no idea who's paying for it, but it's somehow there's like people are giving out these books, like the printing money or something, right? Somebody's paying for this, right? And yet the counter narrative is not well funded like that. It's you know, small guys that are just trying to fight against a machine and, you know, push back and say, hey, what you're being sold is a lie and you'll be better off without it, you know, frankly speaking. Yes, it might give you some peace and satisfaction and prayer and happiness and some of these things you'll find, but overall you're also going to be making a lot of sacrifices. for something that's never going to pay you back. You're never going to get paid back by Allah for all of the things that you're giving him, because he doesn't exist, right? Muhammad had his reasons for doing what he did. The people that preserved the religion and in the way that they wanted to, they did what they want. They got what they wanted out of it. Now, us today, in today's world, I mean, when we look at Islam, it's overall, you know, like you said, it has a lot of barbaric teachings. I mean, just not to mince words, it is a source of terrorism in the world today. I'm not saying it's the only one, of course. We know there's other inspirations for terrorists, not just Islam. And of course, not all Muslims take it, and the majority of Muslims don't take it in that way, which is good. They're better than the religious beliefs. They're able to, the human values shine, overcome the bad teachings in Islam, and the fact that many scholars have, you know, they don't take that sort of approach of, obviously, you know, jihad or whatever. Despite all that, it's still a bad, you know, it's still a source of bad ideas in the world today. So definitely, I want to say thank you as well to you for coming on the channel and for sharing your story and for all of that. And before you share your final words, I just want to suggest or offer people that whoever is new to the channel, please do consider subscribing, joining the channel to continue supporting me. And of course, if you're listening to this on your podcast, please do leave a review on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever it is. And let's get the Abdullah Sumir podcast, your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim podcast, in the top 10 for Islam. I would love to see that next to Mufti Mank and all of the other Zakir Naiks. I'd love to see Abdullah Sumir podcast on iTunes in the top 10. That would be amazing. Is there anything else you wanted to share? Any advice you want to give to fellow Muslims? I know you've told them that this is not true and all that, but anything else you want to share to anybody else, subscribers or viewers? Anything you want? Any final words you want to add?
Well, if there is any Muslim watching, then my advice would be check your own sources and really, see if it's true. You know, don't put that wall, but be open-minded in one way. If you are a convert, then once upon a time, you probably were an open-minded when you converted, because you were open-minded to Islam. So have the same the same thing with leaving it, or maybe leaving it. If you don't want to leave it, don't leave it. I mean, but yeah. You know, but also to those who criticize Islam, criticize it correctly, because just throwing out takiya and this thing that really doesn't, as a Muslim, also as a former Muslim, I didn't know anything about takiya, and this was not a concept where, and read about also those terms you use and this, and really dig into it. Don't just what's being labeled as something that has part to do with Islam. But I can understand the whole takiya thing also, because there's a lot of lying and covering up with Muslim. Also, I to speak straight to the point, when you really have question doubting your religion, is like, you're trying to go around it, and we're not being like totally honest about it. Mm-hmm. You can see the Muslim apologetics. I would probably also leave Islam because of Muhammad Hijab. He's doing a great job. Also, keep watching. Keep the good work, because you really doing a great thing for us ex-Muslims, and spreading Islam in a negative way. So keep up the good work. That's just, I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sven. I do appreciate it, and I think this was a great conversation. And you know, I applaud your courage for coming out. It's not easy to do this in front of so many thousands of people, but I do appreciate it. And you know, is there any? I'm guessing you don't want to share like your social media or anything like that. This is just.
I am not like a social media guy, but
okay.
So I'm not, maybe one day, maybe, but at the moment, no. But yeah, no, I hope it's been good that people benefited from it and found it interesting. I sure have, with all of your conversation you had with people, Abdullah, you keep up the good work, because it's really a refreshing thing when it comes to ex-Muslims. But also everyone, I think.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. All right. So that's a wrap. Thank you, everyone, for joining, and for the moderators for your help in the chat, and for keeping the comments, you know, on topic, and people stopping people from spamming and all that. Again, those of you who are new here, please consider subscribing to the podcast, and leave a review in your favorite podcast app if you're subscribed to the podcast. If not, please subscribe to it and leave a review as well. If you're enjoying the channel on YouTube, we'd love to get, you know, more exposure outside of YouTube as well for the show and for these stories. We want Muslims to see this in the top 10 for Islam. It would be really good. Special, of course, so many thanks to Sven. And we'll see you guys again in the next stream. Bye for now.